And Solomon the son of David was strengthened in his kingdom, and the Lord his God was with him and magnified him exceedingly. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Will.
Hey.
Pat.
Hey.
And Jason.
Good day.
Today we're looking at the second book of Chronicles in our series known as the Holy Bible Book Club. And my first question to the three of you and to anybody listening at home, did you notice anything different or get any new revelations about the character of Solomon from Chronicles as compared to the previous books that he appears in Kings and so on?
I mean, this is kind of a retelling of the stories we've gone through. I didn't particularly pick up on any differences.
Yeah, my biggest aha came near the end of it where I was like, wait a second. All these names are a lot like the name Joseph. And I started to break down the English name Joseph, and I was like, Seth, I wonder what that means in Hebrew. That was my big aha. I didn't find out what it meant, because amazing.
I thought you were about to enlighten us there for a minute. I think the biggest thing that I noticed, or not really noticed, but there's kind of something that when I was reading about Solomon before, I was really hung up on the wisdom of Solomon, and I tried to look at it in a different light this time around, and like I kind of saw the wisdom of Solomon being more of a representation of power and just like just power and ability and authority over everybody else. Like that's what they saw as the wisdom, like the unquestionableness of Solomon's word. I think that's what they mean by the wisdom. Does that make any sense to you guys?
Yeah, and that's the only thing that I picked up on, to be honest.
I missed it entirely. I was figuring out what Seth meant. He will add.
So when they talk about the wisdom of Solomon, we obviously have, you know, a definition of wisdom that has to do with intellect and all of that, but I think in this context, in Second Chronicles, and before that even, they used wisdom as more of like a symbol of authority and not being able to question him and just like his word being the authority. You know, I think it wasn't just they admired him because he was so smart. They made him into the image of what it was to be smart and powerful, and I think they just got that really from his, you know, authority and his laws and rules and his dictations being what brought them forward. Like, because of him, they got the temple. Because of him, the whole land prospered. So they just used that as the wisdom of Solomon.
Well, they would have stoned you for saying such blasphemy, because I mean, ultimately the authority is coming from God, who set Solomon up through David to be the king. And so when Solomon asked for wisdom, I saw it more as that he wasn't asking for riches or strength. He was asking to be kind of a vessel through God's word.
The way I see it is like what he was asking for is for everyone else to perceive him as wise, or at least that's what he got in the end. Because you can't just be like, make me a wise man, and then all of a sudden, you're a wise man.
But that's not what it was, right? Like, he didn't approach God with arrogance. He humbly asked for the wisdom to lead his people, and because he came with such a pure heart, he was given the power and the riches and the ability to execute his will, and that was his, capital H, will. Not Solomon's will, but God's. And, you know, he was set up to build the second temple, as Jason was saying, in David's time. And I think what we see is a metaphor, you know, throughout all Second Chronicles, is that the kings set up by God, who honor God and go for the right way and follow the template, are rewarded. And that it is enacting his will in the appropriate context that leads to the most highest return on investment, right? Because you can only execute so many plans. And this is, of course, a hindsight retelling of the stories of these kings, right? So it's very easy to say, you know, when they got it right, that it was because they honored God. And when they got it wrong, it was because they didn't. And it's probably very obvious, too, that you can't have great success in a nation if you have a house divided and you have people going off and worshiping idols, because you're not, you know, 100 arrows aimed at an army. You're 100 arrows aimed willy-nilly, but the forces of the universe are still at hand. And if you're not entering that battle on the same page, then you're going to get defeated by the inevitability of nature and empires and struggling power complexes in the world at large. And that's what I took away from it.
Well, this idea of, you know, not worshiping idols and having one God is set forth in the Ten Commandments. It's part of the original covenant with Moses and Abraham that you're going to worship me, and it's like through God's voice, you know, and nobody else. And it's similar, it's very similar to what Jordan Peterson's talking about in his Beyond Order with the phrasing of a single interpretive perspective on reality.
I think one of the other big messages too is that it's not just about saying, you know, ignorantly follow in the ways of the system that you've aligned yourself to, but in fact, you need the ceremony, ritual, tradition, song, scripts to meditate on. It's this giant sort of lifestyle that you have to willingly devote yourself to. And you can't do that if you're going to a shrine of idols in your basement. Shout out to collectors of frickin' everything. Like, and it's just, it's a question of man hours, as my dad would call it, right? Like, if you're focused on two things, they both suffer.
Right.
Like, if you want to write a book, you can pretend that you can write five books at the same time while reading five books, while learning an instrument, while maintaining your health and your social circle. And it's like, guess what? You'll never get it done this month because you're not fully obsessing and using all of your faculties to do this properly. And if you split your focus, you don't get to see what you're focusing on come to fruition. And that's what makes, you know, organized religion so enticing, because they give you a whole system and a routine and a schedule that for a lot of individuals, they just cannot impose upon themselves, because it's not supposed to be a one-man army. You're supposed to have a group of guys. I mean, the four of us can attest to the fact that if you just meet once a week to become accountable to the things that you're telling yourself you're going to do, it reevaluates how your brain functions, and you get more motivation, you get more grit, you get more discipline and persistence. And it's like, imagine if you woke in the morning and prayed to a higher force to ask for the strength and the wisdom to achieve your goals. And at your low points, you sang. And when you missed your mark, you confessed your failings, because that's what you get. And belief in God is first and foremost the ability to apologize and to seek forgiveness and to be forgiven and to stop hyperfixating on your shortcomings, but to know that this is the path and this is what it looks like. Sometimes you're standing on it and moving forwards, and other times you're sitting in the weeds and you're confused. And if you don't have someone there, and someone who's been there for thousands of years saying the same thing, making it more practical, more serious, having survived the test of time, it's hard to convince yourself that it's okay.
That was beautiful, Will. You know, the aspect of ritual in life is something that I think we appreciate, because ritual can transform a person that's lost and feels like they have no meaning. It can provide them, inject into what they want to do, a sense of meaning, and it gives them that sense of purpose. It's like if you don't have a ritual when you wake up in the morning versus you cultivate a ritual of, okay, well, I'm going to go on a walk. I'm going to maybe go take a breath of fresh air and, you know, maybe pray to something greater than my feelings and myself at this moment. you know, it's a very powerful motivator.
Well, and it's like it eradicates comfort zone tunnel vision, right? You wake up in your comfort zone. Why work? Why change? You're comfortable. And the answer is usually, well, because I could, and I'd like to see what would happen. But you don't think about that until you stop taking the world for granted and you open up your eyes again and you say, oh, right, this is what people do. You know, my mother would love to see me do this. My wife, my friends, my peer group would love to see me do this. It would make them happy. It would make me happy. And it would be interesting. And it would be living. But when you're in your comfort zone, you can stagnate. And you can't really do that when you have a community that has hope and believes in you and loves you and wants to give you as many resources as they have at their disposal to help you benefit yourself.
And then there's this idea of the Passover, which is later brought up near the end of Second Chronicles. And just the idea of bringing everybody together to celebrate. And it's kind of like, you know, saying that you have come so far after everything that you've gone through. It's time to, you know, just gather around and, you know, look back at what you've accomplished and then, you know, celebrate moving forward.
And reproof your vows, right? And have a structure at the community level that says we are all doing this intentionally and for this purpose, and we're celebrating and we're honoring. And if you don't have that system, if you go a year without having a feast with a peer group or a community group or a support group to celebrate and lament and look forward and reflect, then you're not the kind of person that has that support structure, and lobster brain says you get less serotonin.
Yeah, there's definitely something about, you know, attending a church, the ritual of coming together as a fellowship where you get some boost. I think most people would say that boost is, you know, either a serotonin neuromodulatory aspect, or it's like the divine grace of God, right? You know, you're either one side of the table on that one. But whenever you're doing a ritual, I think it's important to reflect on, you know, is that action a beautiful action or, you know, something destructive? Because these people in the Old Testament, it's, you know, around the Bronze Era, they're in the land of Canaan, and there's people worshiping other or deities like Baal, right? And they're doing child sacrifices, burning people, throwing them into the light of the fire. And I don't see how that's something that's beautiful. But at the same time, the Yahwehists are sacrificing animals. You know, that's probably
tens of thousands of animals.
Well, you got to eat something.
So do they eat these sacrifices, I guess, is the question.
Well, it talks about the certain, like, choice sacrifices going to the Levites, and that's basically all they're allowed to eat at all is what gets sacrificed. So
okay.
And this, so is, they... this, sorry, you just reminded me, like, this is the book where the collection comes out. Right? We get the collection from the church.
Oh, and the they collection go out. Plate, yeah.
Well, the collection chest. Like, they get bank, and they pay for stuff. And I think it's the first time I've seen the collection since the tabernacle, and I don't really know how much that really got looked at up until now.
Yeah, I think it's part of, like, I think that all counts as part of Solomon's wisdom, is like, well, we need to start accepting donations if we're going to build this temple, right? Gotta start somewhere.
That's the other thing that a community offers, right? Because you get a big enough community and you do collection, like you take 10% of your income as charity and you all pool it together, you can have a lot more impact than, like, if I went out and bought produce, I could only get a bag for my 10% of my income. But if the four of us put together our 10% and went out to get produce, we could get six times as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exponential when you start to buy in bulk and start to plan and actually endeavor to do something greater, 10 times the size of what you had in mind for your own self. That it necessitates all of these structures of order in order to achieve, and it becomes easier because it's hard to lift a car by yourself, but you can take a car a kilometer with enough men.
Yeah, if you take turns pushing.
I say this like 2 weeks ago, my wife was pushing a car up a driveway without any assistance. But that's the thing, you know, when you have God on your side, you can move mountains, you can topple cities. And how easy is it to topple a city that's divided? It's like in the Battle of Five Armies, they cut off the head of the general in The Hobbit, and all of the forces scatter. But if each of us were a general under the same flag, what impact would it have had?
So, because we're reading Lord of the Rings, this thought kind of creeps into my mind. Is God kind of like the puppet master or like Sauron? He controls humans, you know, with he doesn't have a ring, but he has the Ark of the Covenant. And what if it was Abraham's sacrifice of his son Isaac that was kind of the turning point where he gained that power over us?
I think it's not that simple. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong, Abraham didn't kill his son, right? He just got to the point that he would have. And it's that willingness to sacrifice to power that makes that power manifest in of its own creation. Because if you're not willing to do that for it, how much power can it have to be good for you? Right? And it's this unconscious sort of evaluation strategy that allows you to say, like, if you have to ask a big enough question in order to get a noble enough answer, right? Like, if you're not aiming for the stars, you're stuck in the dust.
Right. Abraham kind of serves as this model of faith. You know, he will do anything that the Lord asks of him. We are told in the Bible that he doesn't kill his son, but it seems like that could have been a revision added later. I mean, we'll never know.
Yeah. Looking into that question has been crazy, dude. Because I just wanted to like explain that for a bit, because we've talked about the E and the J document before, like the people that called God Elohim and the people that called God Yahweh come from two different sources. And the Elohim version, there's a strong case to suggest that Abraham did in fact just sacrifice his kid on top of the mountain. So that, I don't know what to say about that. Who knows if there's anything to it or not, but
I mean, whether he did it or not, he was 100% committed to doing it.
Yeah. But like the part where like the angel comes in and stays Abraham's hand, it only really pops up in the Yahweh, the J document version of it.
Here's the thing, right? Because Abraham's son and the bond that is held between them is agape. And God and the children of God and the bond that is held between them is agape. And you can't get agape without agape. That's the first rule of alchemy. You cannot receive something that you didn't put in the first place. And when you look at Isaac Asimov's Guide to the Bible and the discussion of Cain and Abel being these mythological story archetypes for agriculture and nomadicism, and you look at the story of Abraham and Isaac, like, it didn't happen, but this is how you tell the story. You say, the God asked of me to kill my son. And all the parents say, oh my goodness, we love our children though. We could never do that. And he's like, no, wait, he stopped me. But it was my commitment to follow his will that I had to have to receive his bounty. And now he nurtures me as I do my children. And they're like, what? Truly, I tell you, if you have faith in his ways, you too can receive the love of God. And it's like a great mythological origin story. Like, you're creating something way more manifest than all of these deities that are in the land asking for babies.
Yeah, and that's what agape is. It's creation through love. Like, we create each other through love.
The nurture and the forgiveness and the understanding and the wisdom, right? Like, wisdom isn't intelligence, it's experience and foresight and forgiveness. And who else could have that but some sort of crazy existential being that you don't quite understand, that's going to ask just as much as you're capable of giving and is going to throw at you just as much as you're capable of receiving? Like, how could it be anything else? Because that's every interaction you have with good parents.
So the question that's popping up into my mind is, why did God not really forgive Adam and Eve for, you know, eating the fruit from the tree of garden in the Garden of Eden? It seems like he has held that against humanity for until, I guess, Jesus comes around.
Because, well, that's this whole notion of original sin, right? And if you look at sin as the Greek word for having missed your mark, original sin's beautiful, because it's like, of course we're born with original sin. We can't even freaking speak. We can't feed ourselves. We're constantly missing the mark of survival and procreation. And it is only through agape that we get to a place where we can start to live in grace. But when he created Adam and Eve in this, you know, existential mythological creation story, you know, he gave them everything that they needed, and he created a place that was perfect for them, and he didn't give them the knowledge of good and evil, which is that wisdom that God has and he has full mastery over. And while they got a taste of the fruit, they didn't get the essence, the logos, the being of knowledge of good and evil, the understanding of it. They got the ability to see it. It altered their identity and their vision. And of course you're going to get judged for that, because you missed the mark. You had it perfect. You could have just stayed in this garden forever as my perfect children, but that's not what we were made to be. And maybe he didn't understand that when he was making us, but what he made us do is be imperfect and evolve and make mistakes and fail forwards.
Yeah, I think you have to look at it like they had options. Like, Adam and Eve had the option of not touching the fruit and staying exactly where they were. But because of our nature, maybe God didn't know our nature to begin with, and he just, oh, here's something I created, I wonder what they'll do. So he was just genuinely curious. Or maybe it was just like, here's the test, and you're going to pass, and passing means you have to leave the garden. That's just what the story means. Like, if you're going to make the decision to understand good and evil, you can't stay in this place where good and evil don't exist.
Well,
you
know,
you have to transcend. You have to face the chaos and the order at the point when you understand good and evil. Or you could stay here and be happy. Your choice.
But nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like any good video game designer knows, the Mario concept of introducing concepts. You show them how to do it once very easily, and then the goal is to take that strategy and make it harder. You know, jump up twice, jump up on a thing. And for us, it was consume something. It will change you. Now consume more and hopefully do good.
Yeah, this I wanted to bring up for a while, like just in relation to Nietzsche and religious ideas. I've always found it kind of like insulting, the notion that knowledge can be dangerous. Do you know what I mean?
It can be.
Well, I disagree. But I think there's like a lot of people make the case that as soon as you like reach this threshold of higher intelligence, you're going to be miserable. And I really think that like miserableness just comes from when you lose the drive to keep jumping over these hurdles, you know, like as soon as you try to become smarter, you're going to find two other things that you know nothing about. So like that's where the chaos sets in. And I think that's what people mean by like knowledge can be dangerous, but I like to see it as more of an opportunity. Like now I see more of why I'm miserable, and now I can further, you know, aim towards that goal of I have something else to aim at now. And other people would say something like, oh, that's just too much chaos for me to deal with. I'm just too smart for my own good. Become a nihilist.
You're saying two things, because you said knowledge is dangerous, but then you actually talked about knowledge making you miserable. And so that's not inherently dangerous, and it's a separate thing. And I think it's kind of the reflection of ignorance being bliss, right? And it's not, is knowledge dangerous? It's, is having the capacity to process your place in this world and consider multiple perspectives intrinsically going to make you more miserable about your suffering and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, no, there's a meaning crisis. And if you know too much, but not enough, and you don't have a structure to funnel your processes through, and you start doing the stagnant action of thinking, then you're going to be miserable, because thinking isn't a doing. And that isn't the point. Like, the point is a doing or a being, and thinking should only serve you for as quickly as you can establish what to do or how to feel in the context that you're in with the resources that you have. And if you get lost in your mind, that sucks, and you can get miserable, and you can get nihilistic, or you can get blissfully, you know, excluded from the world, you know, find your cave and become woke. But again, that's wrong. Like, you shouldn't hide in the garden. You shouldn't hide in the cave. And if your knowledge doesn't better the world, then it is destructive.
Yeah, like when I look at the Adam and Eve taking the fruit, I honestly think there was no way not to take the fruit and still grow. And you just have to find a way. Once you have that fruit, once you have that knowledge of good and evil, you have to keep eating more fruit to satisfy that hunger. And I think that's what life is all about.
Yeah.
And in the same way that like Nietzsche says that God is dead and we all have killed him, I think that's a fruit that we need to eat too. I think that's something that we kind of have to understand happened. And like, well, this is what I'm talking about with like the danger of knowledge. Like, people will say that you shouldn't read Nietzsche because he's dangerous. Like, that's the kind of rhetoric people use. Like, no, it's, that'll lead you into nihilism and down a dark road, and you know,
well, it's like
there's going to be nothing good there. But I'm like, well, there is if you keep going. I mean, you can't stop at Nietzsche. He has a lot of good points, but you know, there's more to it than just that.
I saw this post on Instagram last night about this teacher in the States somewhere that's like trying to get their students to not play the devil's advocate role in discussion. And then this huge comment chain about this person who clearly did not understand what devil's advocate was. But they basically took it literally and said that the devil's advocate mechanism of debate is someone who is friends with Satan and believes in terrible things and speaks to confirm, like, they support the Holocaust denial controversy, and they're like pro rape and pro murder, and they're just constantly like, if someone's having a good day, they shit on them. And it's like, dude, you have a terrible friend in your life and you need to get them out of here. But the point of devil's advocate is to bring awareness to the discussion. And it's not about justifying terrible things. It's like, have you considered this? Because you're making this point, and this point completely crumbles your point. And if you're not galvanized towards that, you're ignorant and a fool. And that's the problem with knowledge and the consumption of knowledge without meaning, right? If you don't have a point to consuming it, why are you consuming it? Like, if you don't have, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? What is your goal? What is your plan? What is your timeline? How is it specific, measurable, and the A, and relevant and timely? Like, what are you actually trying to do? Why are you so miserable? Like, but when we get stuck in this meta, high level, low resolution discussion of, oh, this or that, and, you know, objective philosophical posturing. It's a waste of time.
Yeah.
It's like, is your room a mess? Clean it up. Have you fed yourself well? Feed yourself. Do you floss? Do you brush? Are you drinking water? Are you exercising? Are you in a position to work gainfully? Are you in a position to volunteer? Are you in a position to make good art? Okay, why aren't you doing it? Oh, well, I have these thoughts. Okay, you need a system of forgiveness. You need a system of acknowledging your triggers and getting your brain back so that when you think that you see a saber-toothed tiger and it's actually just a liberal, you don't pull your spears out.
Right. We can long for going back to the garden, but if you think about it, like in terms of Neverland, maybe we were set up such that, you know, that tree was waiting for us. Yeah. And it was waiting for us so that we would eventually have to leave that garden, right? We have the knowledge now of the difference between good and evil. What are we going to do with that knowledge? Are we going to transmute it into wisdom like Solomon asks for as his gift? Or are we just going to accumulate more and more knowledge that, you know, doesn't serve us?
So two other things really quickly. If Adam and Eve hadn't eaten the fruit of the tree, the story would have just read like this. And they had everything they needed for all of their days. And then eventually they got sick of it and they ate the fruit. Like, there was only one way out of that story. Like, yeah. It was very linear, very simple. And that was the only escape. The other thing, and it's funny that you bring up Neverland, Jason, is when Tinkerbell dies, they bring her back to life by believing in her. And if God is dead and we killed him, then we have just as much ability to sacrifice our own ego into the rebirth of that structure that forgives us and raises us and cares for us and unites us.
Yeah, I like that. It may sound corny, but love is the answer.
Love and wisdom. And a bit of discipline. A heck of a lot more understanding. Oh my goodness. Read more books.
Yeah. Like, that's just goes into my point of, you know, knowledge being dangerous is only dangerous or can only make you miserable if you give up on it. If you're the kind of person that reads a book every day and then you stop, that's gonna suck for a while.
Well, it's almost like confusing knowledge with dogma is dangerous. You know, like you have a couple traumatic incidents with a couple individuals or mechanisms of society, and you make the incorrect conclusion that this equals that, and you start living out your life thinking this truth and thinking that it's dogma and incontrovertibly true. And it's like, well, no, actually, black people are humans. And you're just a racist bigot who stopped learning when you were 12. For a specific example, so that people understand. Because otherwise, it's just all low-resolution crap that I'm saying.
Yeah, well, this book actually does mention at one point, never suffer a witch or wizard to live. So it's telling you to kill people that practice witchcraft.
Depends how you define suffer, right?
Never undergo a witch or wizard to live. Never
suffer a witch to live. Okay, fine. I won't suffer a witch to live. But that doesn't mean kill witches. That means don't allow the spells cast by witches to impact your suffering, doesn't it? Like, don't hang around with petty tyrants. Don't hang around with witches. When the company that you have stops following the principle that you hold to be true, slip on the ring and abandon them all and maintain your quest. And if someone's willing to come with you to achieve your goal, then do so. But Don't go fight Saruman just because he's a bad guy. You have the ring and you need to destroy it, Frodo.
Yes.
It's probably a good point to point out that none of us are Bible scholars. We're just reading this book.
If you didn't figure that out by now, you aren't either.
Yeah.
I just assume by 5 minutes deep, anybody who's woke enough to disregard us either disregards us entirely or loves us absolutely.
Yeah. I'd really like to see what, like, a really serious Christian has to say about some of our conversations, because I don't know, it could go both ways. This blasphemy shouldn't be let out in the world. This kind of rhetoric is dangerous. Or, oh, maybe these four lads will become Christian by the time they're done the New Testament.
Well, I'm sure that anyone wise enough watching would probably look at us stumbling around aimlessly in the dark like children.
I hope that's the case, because that's exactly how I present myself. I identify as stumbling child, lost in the darkness.
I'm emotionally invested in my ignorance, and I'm completely willing to abandon any of my stances, but prove me wrong. Change my mind.
Yes.
Give me something to consume or chew on.
So we were talking about Second Chronicles. What else was there?
That's it. We're going to wrap it up, and we're going to move on to our accountability meeting and encourage everyone watching to do the same.
You know, that's a good point. Like, let's just wrap this up and go to church, right?
Word. Pat?
Any final words?
No final word. This was a, you know, really short and kind of a filler book, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
Join us next time for the Book of Ezra. Going through the Lord of the Rings. We're going through Jordan Peterson's new book. Watch another video. It's good for you.